Hello, everyone. Welcome to Bible Discoveries, the weekend show. It is our first show of 2026. I'm here with my husband, Matlock. My name's Corey, if this is your first time with us. Hi, Matlock.
What's going on? Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, everybody. We hope that you had a good holiday season and that you're ready to jump into the scriptures. I know that it's only January 2nd when this is being released, so you've only got a couple days of Bible reading under your belt. But today we are going to be taking a look at Genesis 1 to 9 and Psalm 1 to 3 because that's our first official week of January. Really, it's Thursday to Sunday. So we have an opportunity to kind of slow down and focus in on the beginning of Genesis, which is
That's
exciting.
Right.
Okay, so the weekend show. This is where we review our week's reading because we're reading through the entire Bible in 2026 again. And we discuss big issues that pop up as we read the scripture. And we also discuss your questions that you send us via the comment section and also through email if you're not watching this on YouTube. BibleDiscoveryTV.com. You can find all of our contact info there if you're not watching or listening on YouTube. But for this year, I have heard you. I have received your emails. I have seen the comment section. There's only been a few requests in the comment section on YouTube. We've gotten more emails and even phone calls here at the Canadian office about bringing back the weekly recap, which is where I just take a couple minutes and I go through kind of a bullet point list of what it is that we read in the Bible this week. So here we go. We're doing Genesis 1 to 9 and Psalm 1 to 3. Are you with me?
I'm here. I have no choice.
We are forcing him to read through the Bible with us, guys. All right. Are you ready? Here we go. Okay, I wrote notes for myself, so I'm going to be glancing down at my iPad. Okay. Genesis 1. Of course, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth was formless and void, and darkness was over the face of the... Okay. We know this. Okay. So Genesis 1. This is the account of creation, days 1 through 6. So on day 1, God creates light and he separates the light from the darkness. He names the light day and the darkness night. On day 2, he creates the firmament. On day 3, water is gathered together to make the dry ground and the sea distinct from one another. So we have sea, water, and land. Also on day 3, vegetation grows on the land, so plants. On day 4, God creates the sun, the moon, and the stars. We're told they're for knowing the seasons and the days and like a clock. Day 5, God creates water creatures. So fish, water beasts, whales. By water beasts, I mean like whales and things, you know, and also birds. So he's filling those two zones. He's filling the air. He's filling the water with living creatures.
The word for sea beasts is tannin. It's dragon.
It's dragon.
It's Hebrew. Yeah.
Water dragons. Loch Ness. Is that what you're saying? Are you saying Loch Ness?
It's the word for dragon. ESV translated beasts, but I think it's tannin. It's the same word that's used to describe dragons.
Love it.
Anyway, sorry.
Love it. Okay, there's a whole weird episode in there somewhere. Day 6, still in Genesis chapter 1, God creates animals on the ground. He creates insects, living creatures, and mankind, of course. This is where we make our grand entrance. We're told that mankind is made in the image of God. Male and female are made in the image of God. Mankind is told to be fruitful and multiply to fill the earth and rule it. Okay, Genesis chapter 2, we get the seventh day of creation, which is God resting. And then we get a retelling of the creation story, but this time from the point of view of man, of the creation of man. So it's an emphasis on the creation of mankind, zooming in to that day 6 creation of man. Okay, so creation day 7, God rests from his creation. So he's no longer actively creating the universe and he inaugurates the Sabbath. So the day of rest, he makes it holy. He makes it set apart, distinct, different from other days. Then, of course, moving into this second creation account detailing how humans were made, we see God creating Adam out of the dust of the earth and then breathing life into his body. God puts Adam in the Garden of Eden, and he forbids him from eating from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Any other tree's fine, just not that one. Adam then names the animals as they come to him, and Eve is then created from Adam. And you'll remember that whole thing. God puts him under a deep sleep, takes his rib, makes Eve. Adam's thrilled. It's great. Okay, Genesis 3. The serpent speaks to Eve, trying to convince her to eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And of course, Eve chooses to eat, and Adam chooses to follow her in that eating. God confronts them, and he doles out consequences for this sin of rebellion. We get the serpent being cursed and a messianic prophecy, a promise of salvation in Genesis 3, verse 15. The consequences for woman is that she will have to toil in her childbearing, and she'll have a different relationship with her husband than she enjoyed previously. For the man, we see he will experience the difficulty of a cursed ground, and he will toil in providing. So there's this hardship and worrying element that's now introduced to the life of mankind. We're also told in Genesis 3 that God made clothes of animal skin to cover their nakedness, which is directly associated in Genesis 3 with shame. So God covers humanity's shame, but it involves the death of an animal. He uses animal skins to do so. God banishes Adam and Eve from the garden so that they cannot eat from the tree of life and live forever. Interesting details. Genesis 4, we get the history of Adam and Eve's children, at least some of their children. So we see Eve having two sons that she names Cain and Abel. Abel is a shepherd. Cain is a farmer. Abel's offering to God, they're older at this point. All of a sudden they're older. Abel's offering to God is accepted. Cain's offering to God is not accepted. Cain becomes angry with Abel over this. There's a jealousy thing that's going on. God confronts Cain to teach him about the nature of sin and what Cain's response should be. But instead, Cain rejects all that and he kills his brother Abel. He murders him. God confronts Cain again. He banishes him from the area that he's living and from working the ground, which was Cain's profession. That's what he did. He was a farmer. Cain would now be cursed to become a wanderer on the earth rather than a tiller of the earth. Cain says that that's more than he can bear because he will be, quote, hidden from your presence, meaning God, hidden from God's presence. And he's afraid that he will be killed by others for this murder. So God puts a mark on Cain for his own safety. And then Cain leaves and establishes the city of Enoch. And we're given the story of Cain's descendants. And it's not great, to say the least. We're also told that Adam and Eve have another son named Seth after Abel is murdered. It's their next son after Abel's death. And the Bible tells us that at that time is when people began to call on the name of the Lord. So does this signify God's presence was removed more? We're not sure, but we know at that point people felt it necessary to begin calling on the name of the Lord. Okay, Genesis 5. We got the genealogy of Adam to Noah. And then we're told that Noah has his sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, when he is very advanced in age. He is 500 years old. Genesis chapter 6. Humanity has become evil at this point. We're told the sons of God mate with women, human women, and the resulting offspring are called Nephilim. Noah also gets a message from God that he needs to build an ark because God is going to judge humanity. All right, Genesis 7, the flood begins. Noah and his family go into the ark. They take 7 pairs of every kind of clean animal, 1 pair of every unclean animal, and 7 pairs of every kind of bird. And then the flood begins. Genesis 8, we got the end of the flood. The water of the flood begins to recede. We're told the flood lasted 150 days altogether. The ark, of course, it comes to rest on Mount Ararat, actually the mountains of Ararat, to see if it was good to leave the ark. Noah let go a, I feel like I should pop quiz you now, Matlock. What did he let go of? Was it a raven or a dove? It was a raven. Okay. Maybe I will start pop quizzing
you. Is this
you
what's happening
in the
now?
Middle of these? Maybe
Is
I should
a
just
thought, a pop
should
thought?
We just pop quiz Matlock? I had an intrusive thought, like make Matlock answer some of these questions. Maybe we should. Let me know in the comment section if I should pop quiz Matlock. Okay. He releases a raven, it comes back. He releases a dove, it comes back. 7 days later, he releases the dove again. This time it comes back with an olive branch in its mouth, that famous image of the dove with the olive branch. This is where it comes from. 7 days later, Noah releases the dove again. This time it doesn't. The dove doesn't come back. Presumably it's found a place to nest and live. So God calls the humans out of the ark. So the family comes out, they build an altar to God, and they sacrifice some of those extra pairs of clean animals to God on the altar. And God promises to never curse the ground or destroy all living creatures with a flood like that ever again. So he's not saying there will never be floods. He's just saying, not like this. Genesis 9, the covenants continues, as does the history of Noah's family. So God blesses them. He gives them a command to be fruitful and multiply. And there's a few elements to this. He tells them animals are going to be afraid of them now. Before apparently they weren't afraid of humanity, which is interesting. Animals can be eaten, only don't eat meat with the blood still in it. That's the caveat there. And a rainbow becomes the sign of God's covenant that he will never flood the earth again. So the true meaning of the symbol of the rainbow. Noah plants a vineyard. He gets drunk and something bad, something sinful happens, something shameful happens when Ham and Canaan see Noah drunk and naked in his tent, and Canaan ends up being cursed by Noah. So there's a whole thing we can talk about there. And that's where our reading in Genesis ends. And of course, on Sunday, we're supposed to read Psalm 1-3.
And Canaan is Ham's son.
Yes.
Yes.
Correct.
There you go. I added it in the pop quiz for you. Yeah.
You did it. I didn't even ask you. And you just did it.
That's right.
Psalm 1-3 is interesting as well. So Psalm 1 introduces a recurring theme in the Psalms, which is the way of the righteous paired up against, contrasted against the way of the wicked.
Right.
So in Psalm 1, the righteous delight in God's law. They meditate on it daily. The wicked don't. And they are like useless chaff. In Psalm 2, we have another theme introduced in the book of Psalms, which is God and then God's king, God's representative on earth, which is interesting. So we see wicked nations rising up against God and against his anointed king. But the righteous find success through serving God and honoring his anointed king. We've got this a thematic connection, if you will, between Psalm 1 and Psalm 2. They both compare the righteous to the wicked, but chapter 1 does that on an individual level. This is what a righteous person looks like versus a wicked person. And Psalm 2 does it on a national level. Here's what a wicked nation looks like. Here's what a righteous nation looks like. It's interesting. Psalm 3 then opens with a note that it was composed by King David in a terrible time when he had to flee Jerusalem. He had to leave Jerusalem for his life. He had abandoned the throne of Jerusalem because of his son Absalom's coup. And the main theme of Psalm 3 is that God is a shield, so we should trust in him at all times. And that's the recap. It's okay. A little bit long-winded, but we got there. I'll have to shorten it down when we have
Yeah, you've opened up a can of worms now I'm thinking about it, because it's like this was a short week.
It was.
So we're going
to... Well, I will shorten it more. I took my time with this one because I knew that we only had to do Genesis 1 tonight.
Fair enough.
But in the future, I will shorten those recaps of the chapters because...
Interesting.
For time's sake.
Yeah, okay, interesting.
What do you think? Did anything strike you there?
Well, you know, Genesis 1 to 9 is always very interesting. There's so much to talk about there. You know, I'm sure there's viewer questions pertaining to it, but like, you know, even the straight Nephilim, there's debate about the sons of God.
Yeah.
Right, what that looks like and like, you know, what are the Nephilim? So some people are like, oh, are the sons of God you know, and fallen angels or whatever. People have a whole bunch of descriptions. Or are they quote unquote giants? Are they just like really like normal people, but just like a what was that? What am I thinking of?
Like legendary,
like Achilles, like above. Yeah, people that are bigger than the
like Nimrod.
Thank you. Yes.
So conquering kings.
Yes.
Infamous, if you will.
Yeah, yeah. I can't remember the euphemism, but yes, yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Men of renown.
The only reason why I don't think it's that, men of renown, is because Nephilim means strange flesh.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean like it would be weird to be like, oh, the kings took everyone's daughters and made, you know, princes. That would be like, oh, that would make sense. But
that's
the cult,
kind of normal.
That's normal. But it says strange flesh, which makes it like why would the king, like a conqueror king taking other people's daughters, having children through them, all of a sudden becomes, it doesn't, to me, that doesn't work. Mm-hmm. So if,
especially because those children are given a specific, like given the title Nephilim.
Yeah.
And then that shows up later.
Yeah.
As giants.
Yes.
Like larger than life.
Yes.
And then when, in Joshua, well, in Exodus, but when the Israelite spies go in to look at the promised land, they come back and they're like, we're like grasshoppers.
Yes.
in comparison. And yes, I know the arguments. I know that could be, well, the people of Israel are smaller in size than the amount of people, like amounts.
Well, if you have like a group of people that are like NBA sized people, and then you have a group of people that are like your size, which is like 5'3".
Yes.
You'd be like, these people are double my size. They're giants. Like they're just huge. So it's like, yes.
And we have even though it's debated, the height of Goliath is debated.
Yeah.
He is called a Nephilim.
Yes.
And so there's two different numbers depending on if you look at the Masoretic text or if you look at the Septuagint,
right,
which is a Greek translation.
Yes.
However, he's still larger than a normal human. Larger than
Much
the
larger.
Average
yes.
average size.
Yeah.
But yeah, it can there are very tall people in this world, okay?
Yeah.
And I don't think personally, I believe that God created the heavens and the earth.
Yeah.
So, and I believe in a spiritual world. So to me, it's not much of a leap to be like, I mean, if there was a somehow there was a weird marrying of spiritual with the physical, could that result in
strange
people
flesh,
who were larger than normal?
Yeah.
I think the answer has to be yes.
Yeah.
But also, like, you're right. I've been to a college volleyball game before.
Yeah.
Those guys are huge. And to me, who is 5'3",
yeah,
literally.
But no, but yeah, even so, my brother's 6'5", right?
Yeah.
So if I'm, it's a, even like, at 5 foot, like six, looking at someone 6'5", you don't think he's a giant. You just think he's big.
But you get someone 7 feet tall.
But 7 feet tall, like, because it adds more width and everything.
It's yes. Great.
But then you get, so, and someone who's 7 feet versus 6'5", it's a huge difference.
Huge difference.
And you're like, whoa, like, that's a big man. But you still don't consider him a giant. Once you start getting to like the 7 foot to 8 foot range, you're
eight
like, hold
range.
On, this is getting big. And so that's kind of like, you would be like, okay, he's really big.
Mm-hmm.
You'd be like really big. So again, I know this context here of how big the Israel, all this different stuff, but yeah, it's the, I think that something spiritual happened there, especially to warrant the flood. Like,
yes,
like
it is directly connected with the reason for the flood.
Yes. This is what makes it. So if you had a conquering kings taking people's daughters to have children,
that happened after
that. Yeah. It's like this, that would, does that warrant the global flood? It's like, well, yeah, it's like, why, you see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I don't think it adds up.
We know that God, the scripture says that God looked on man, he regretted that he made them because the intentions of their heart were continually evil.
Yes.
Continually evil. So something happened to encourage on that process.
Yes.
And the argument for this to be a spiritual event is really biblically interesting when you look at sons of God referencing angelic beings as spiritual beings.
Yes.
It follows.
Yes.
That is where I lean.
And there is a, again, as the argument would be, well, referring to people, because even, mm-hmm. you know, again, Masoretic versus Septuagint.
Yep.
But But again, there's a coalescing relationship here because sons of God is also referring to people because people are, right? Tripart. So it's like you have body, soul, and spirit. So when you think about that, it's like being sons of God, right? Like we're included in this in some sort of sense. And that's what gets people all like, well, what's the narrative context?
But it's, yes, because it's as contrasted to the daughters of men.
Yes.
So there's a contrast between the sons of God and the daughters of men.
Yes.
And
Yes. Just because there's grammatical, like people are like, oh, the grammar here, if you just take this one word and then look at the grammar over here, it's this one word. It's like, well, grammar is dictated by the narrative. It's like, like there is grammar that's like elucidating to how to understand it, but it's like when you read the whole thing, right? The narrative gets more in the grammar gets more informed about what it's supposed to mean. So it's like you could have your definitions all day long, but again, language is pretty fluid. So it's like if the meaning is the sons of God are contrasted to the daughters of men, right? Specifically. And then it creates the flood because strange flesh came in the earth.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, it sounds like something radically happened.
Yeah.
Not your everyday occurrence, right?
And the New Testament books of, this is controversial as well, the New Testament books of Peter and Jude do seem to reference back to this.
Yes.
I know some people say, no, it was a different event, but if you check out 2 Peter and Jude.
So depending, again, what denomination you are, if you're Lutheran, you're going not the spiritual route, but let's say the Michael Heiser route, you're not going that route if you're Lutheran.
Sure.
But if you're going, let's say, you know, like our route, you're going to say, okay,
this looks spiritual.
This looks highly spiritual.
The spiritual world's weird.
It's weird. God,
I mean, not something that we regularly interact with on a conscious level.
Right. So if God became man, which is mysterious enough, okay, so there's weird things. We know weird things that can happen, things that are beyond our understanding, different things. It's like if this is kind of like a what do you want to say, like a perversion of what was to come, and it's like this whole idea that of like Satan and the demonic forces very early on were always going to trying to perverse God's kingdom that was trying to come, and so it ends up being a reflection, like a reversal of the incarnation in a sense, like a distortion of it very early on. So I think narratively, it actually has a stronger relationship in the text for the whole grand meta narrative of scripture than it does the other version. And I think it just, again, and in the media context, like we said, I think it just makes the most sense. And I think that's how it was perceived even by Peter and Jude. And that's the gloomy darkness. We read that last week, right? This idea you read in 2 Peter. These beings were kept in chains in gloomy darkness.
Yeah.
And so, yes. And so, yeah, I think it just...
What astounds me, too, is that... So I know there's controversy over the antediluvian ages, meaning the pre-flood ages of people.
Yeah.
Because they are multiples. I can't remember what number. They are multiples of a certain number. So perhaps they were reckoning years differently than after the flood. Like,
right.
And there's a Sumerian kings list that has the same phenomena with, like... wildly longer ages, like 13,000 years, something like that. But again, multiples of a different number. So maybe they're reckoning time differently.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Maybe we've lost the true ages. But even afterwards, like when you get into Abraham and Isaac, they're still living well beyond 100 years old.
Yes.
And so what's interesting that if you do take it at face value, I'm admitting that it may not be meant to be taken at face value.
Right.
But if you do take those ages at face value, or even if you just say, okay, even if it wasn't like 500 years, 900 years, 800 years, it was still longer than what we experience today. It's kind of a more money, more problems phenomena where you've got longer ages, longer time to compound your sin. You know, where you've got these people living for a very long time. And well, in my mind, I think, well, that should be a mercy because the older you get, the more wisdom you should get, the more you should realize that you're very foolish and your heart is deceptive. But instead, the opposite was happening. They had time to compound and compound and
get worse and worse.
Their sin. So we see that reversal, that after the flood then, nature's not cooperating with you anymore. Your ages are getting shorter and shorter.
Yeah.
You know, life is more difficult.
Yes.
And all of those in a weird way is a mercy from God that inhibits human evil.
Yes.
Interesting.
No, it is interesting.
Interesting.
And it's interesting to think about, when we connect back to Genesis 3, about when you think about the whole context of what's happening here, if Satan falling at this time, I know people say Satan fell before, but I think it makes much more sense if Satan fell in Genesis 3, because it was like all the whole event took place at once. It wasn't like God like didn't see Satan coming. It was like, you know, God was protecting Eden. It was good. Ezekiel 28. Anyways, but like when you think about everything happening with Satan falling, people, you know, people falling at the same time, all of a sudden God's estrangement of mankind becomes a mercy. God's showing mercy on people by allowing them to physically die,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to having a spiritual death,
mm-hmm.
like for eternity. So he's giving them like time to repent, whereas Satan has there is no repentance.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, when you think about it, mankind was deceived in ignorance, all this different stuff, and voluntarily fell into sin. Death all of a sudden becomes a mercy, and our short ages, like you were saying, shortening of the ages, is becoming a mercy.
Yeah.
And then you think about that in relation to the New Testament, where it says that the days weren't shorter, right? Mm-hmm. Man would not continue on. Whatever the verse is, sorry, it's just having an off day. But yeah, the shortening of days, I think it's Matthew 24. That concept.
If the
still
days weren't shortened.
Yes. Yeah. And some people are like, well, is it going to be 23-hour days? Like, what is it? Like, is it just always nighttime? It's like, well, no, it's like, there's more to it than that. Anyways, but it's connected to this idea of like this mercy.
God ending something
yeah.
is not always a sign of his judgment. Or just his judgment. It's also a merciful judgment.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. It's a similar concept in Isaiah. It talks about how precious in the sight of the Lord are the death of his saints, the death of the righteous man. And people don't consider it enough. It's actually in Isaiah. You don't consider this enough, that the righteous man is removed from the face of evil.
Yes.
So it is a mercy of God as much as it is a judgment.
Yeah.
Amazing. Okay, I have a comment here from Sudeep. I'm so sorry. I'm really bad at pronouncing all of these names, but they say, I'm not happy to hear and read this chapter, Genesis 3. God is love, but we are born in sin, lustful thoughts. I am not happy when I read Genesis, first sin and lost every soul. Yeah, it's not a very happy.
No.
Not a very pleasing.
But also too, when you read Genesis, what makes it so beautiful is, okay, so Genesis, how it's described, this is all of Genesis, but especially early on,
mm-hmm.
is that we had communion with God. Mm-hmm. He was walking in the cool of the day.
Mm-hmm.
Like there was communion with the Lord.
Thanks so much for joining us today. I really hope you enjoyed the discussion. If you want to finish off the discussion and hear an extra bonus question that Matlock and I are going to talk about, then hop on over to our YouTube channel, which is my name, Corey Babechko. You can even join us in the comment section if you want.